we want to be sure that any cloud that comes over Alaska and the sustainability of our fisheries, that we address that immediately.
The state works to keep Alaska salmon on Walmart shelves. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Army Corps builds the case for a deepwater port near Nome.
This is a viable project, and it definitely provides more benefits to the nation than it does, than it will cost.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
For months, Walmart and state officials have gone back and forth on whether Alaska salmon should be sold in their stores. The dispute is over a tiny blue sustainability label from the Marine Stewardship Council, which Walmart requires for their seafood. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that a trip by Walmart executives to Juneau has left state officials optimistic for a resolution.
As executive director of DIPAC, Eric Prestigard is used to giving tours. Every year, tens of thousands of people visit the hatchery in Juneau to see how they raise salmon.
This is the kind of thing you're only going to see something like this in Alaska. This is very unique to Alaska, what you're seeing in here. These are incubators.
This Wednesday, his tour group is a little unusual. It's made up of half a dozen Walmart executives fresh in from Arkansas to learn about Alaska seafood. Prestigard takes them to a dark room that looks like a server farm. But instead of computer equipment, the towers are full of tiny young salmon with fresh water flowing through them.
So you can see the fry swimming in there. See them? And you see the little pink belly? So they still have their yolk sac. They're not ready yet. See the little pink belly?
DIPAC was just one of the stops for the Walmart crew. They visited Alaska Glacier Seafoods, they talked with state biologists, and they ate a catered meal of, what else, Alaska salmon. This was all part of the state's charm offensive to make sure Alaska salmon stays in Walmart and Sam's Club freezers. Since June, Alaska politicians have been at loggerheads with the company because of a policy to only carry seafood that has a Marine Stewardship Council logo on it. While nearly all of the state's salmon fisheries have been certified by the MSC more than once, some Alaska seafood processors no longer want to pay the extra fee for their label. They think going through the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute certification process should be enough to prove they operate sustainably. On top of that, the MSC has been slow to recertify hatchery salmon in Prince William Sound, which has ruffled some in the industry. While Walmart's executives weren't available for reporter questions during the tour, Prestigard says the whole situation's left the company in a pickle, having to choose between the industry standard for sustainability and Alaska fish.
Oddly enough, I feel a little bit bad for Walmart because I kind of feel like they're in a rock and a hard spot. They have one side, these NGOs and whatnot, are kind of hitting on them saying, you know, you said you're going to do X, Y, and Z, sustainability, blah, blah, blah. And then they have the fact that they're a huge U.S. retailer and they can't buy from the U.S. And I think that that does go to their core.
While this whole conflict has played out, Walmart has continued to stock Alaska salmon. And now that the Walmart executives who handle seafood and sustainability issues have visited the state, Commerce Commissioner Susan Bell is hopeful that they'll keep on stocking it, even if it doesn't carry an MSC label.
They're committed to Alaska seafood, it's important to their customers, and they're not bound to a single certifier.
Keeping Walmart as a customer isn't just an important financial move for the state. While the company does buy millions of pounds of Alaska salmon, the reputational impact that would come from losing them might be as, or even more vital than the dollars directly attached to their decision.
We want to be sure that any cloud that comes over Alaska and the sustainability of our fisheries, that we address that immediately.
The flip side of that is keeping Walmart committed to MSC products is also important to the London-based sustainability organization. While MSC declined an interview for this story, they've traded volleys with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute over the past year over whose certification program is more rigorous. For its part, Walmart seems optimistic that they can carry Alaska salmon without going back on their sustainability pledge. In a statement, Vice President of Meat and Seafood David Baskin wrote that, quote, "Walmart has proudly sourced seafood from the state of Alaska for many years, and we continue to do so." In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
As the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers finalizes details of its deepwater port recommendations, the agency is anticipating continued heavy development in northern and western Alaska. The plan expects not only increased vessel traffic in the Bering Straits region, but offshore drilling in the Chukchi Sea and graphite production at a fledgling mining claim on the Seward Peninsula. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Lorraine Cordova is with the Army Corps of Engineers and serves as the Deepwater Port Studies Economics Team Lead and Project Technical Lead. In her opinion, the addition of a deepwater port in western Alaska is a net gain.
This is a viable project, and it definitely provides more benefits to the nation than it does, than it will cost. So we're hopeful to have this out on the street and into Congress's hands by December of 2014 so that they can make a decision to authorize and or fund the project.
While details are not settled, both of the project's favored locations, Port Nome and Port Clarence, are on the Seward Peninsula. Many of the plan's final details hinge on the Corps' 50-year economic forecast for the Arctic. Much of that forecast is based on data collected in Nome on skyrocketing vessel traffic moving through the local port facilities. According to figures from the Port of Nome, growth in almost every measurable category is not just up, but way up. Revenues collected from cargo, fuel, and gravel have been steadily increasing for two decades, and it's not just freight. All kinds of boats, from government ships to pleasure vessels, are stopping in Nome in greater number. Most telling, 150 vessels were kept at roadstead last season, meaning they couldn't get serviced by the harbor, either because of weather, draft restrictions, or congestion. The Army Corps of Engineers not only takes the current economic situation into account, but is basing recommendations on predictions of expanding activity in different sectors. Cordova says their report anticipates heavy development projects in the region that would be served by nearby support facilities.
We've incorporated the Graphite One mine coming online and moving their graphite product out of the Port of Nome. We've incorporated oil and gas exploration and production activity for Shell, Crowley, and Statoil, you know, assuming that if there was a deep draft port available for their use closer to their Chukchi and Beaufort Sea leases, that they would prefer to use that port.
The inclusion of Vancouver-based Graphite One's claim on the Seward Peninsula is highly speculative. The project's status is unclear, although Jack DeMarkey with the Department of Natural Resources said in November the company is still in the preliminary stages of data collection.
I would characterize it as early to mid-stage exploration, meaning they're concentrating on core drilling. So I think they'll continue to do that for a couple of more years, and then they will very quickly start using that information to start coming up kind of with a conceptual plan for how they might mine it.
Graphite One erroneously states in its promotional materials that the claim's viability is supported in part by access to a deepwater port in Nome. Graphite One has not responded to several months of repeated attempts over phone and email by KNOM for clarification on the project's status. If the federal government decides to pursue the Corps' recommendations, it would foot 65% of the bill. The other 35% would come from the project's chief sponsor, the state of Alaska. Final feasibility report from the Army Corps of Engineers is due out in March. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The U.S. Senate has been debating all week whether to extend emergency unemployment compensation for the long-term unemployed. Some 6,500 Alaskans were receiving the extended benefits before Congress let the program expire on December 28th. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of six Republicans who voted with the Democratic majority to advance the bill on Tuesday. But she and other Republicans say they want changes, and the bill's passage is now uncertain. Murkowski says she has misgivings about another extension to what was intended to be emergency help for the recession.
I don't think that the plan, the desire here, is that you have a benefits program that continues indefinitely. What we want to try to do is get people to work. And so how we do that through reforms, I think, is something that we need to look at.
Murkowski joined the chorus of Republicans demanding a way to pay for the extension that won't add to the national debt. Alaska Senator Mark Begich, a Democrat, was absent for Tuesday's vote, but says he supports the extension. The original bill would fund the long-term benefits program for 3 more months at a cost of about $6.5 billion, although sponsors are pressing to extend it for most of the year. If it becomes law, the program would allow a jobless Alaskan up to 37 additional weeks of unemployment compensation after exhausting the standard 26-week benefit. Supporters say it would boost the economy while helping more than a million Americans pay their bills and continue their job search. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Talkeetna resident describes his membership in the exclusive and extreme 300 Club.
There's definitely enough of us that are like, oh yeah, you got to do the 300 Club, because how many people on this planet can say they've ever done that?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Governor Sean Parnell has appointed a new public safety commissioner. Gary Folger, who retired from the department as a colonel last May, has been chosen to replace Joe Masters. Masters resigned in October after 5 years in the post. The appointment is subject to legislative approval. Colonel Keith Mallard has been acting as interim commissioner. According to information provided by the governor's office, the 55-year-old Folger began his law enforcement career in 1979 with the Division of Fish and Wildlife Protection in Cantwell. There continues to be concern in Fairbanks about proposed state regulations aimed at reducing fine particulate pollution from wood stoves and boilers. The latest in a series of public meetings on the proposals, a hearing and open house this week, drew big turnouts. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The proposed regulations, which include the ability to ban wood burning, are under attack from both sides of the air quality issue. Some are concerned the regs will limit their ability to heat, while others are worried they don't do enough to reduce sometimes dangerous smoke levels. Cindy Heil, an official with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, describes public participation as strong and diverse.
We're getting it all over, the whole spectrum, from very upset that these regulations are not strong enough, to very upset that we're doing them at all, that we should not be having regulations.
Heil says the feedback is helping the DEC refine what it's proposing. She cites input from a local heating contractor. Jim Gibbertoni, who installs and maintains boilers and furnaces, is critical of a proposed hourly emission standard for new wood-burning appliances.
I talked to 2 or 3 manufacturers already, and they basically said they can do whatever they want up in Alaska. It's not a big enough market. We're not going to design something just for Fairbanks, Alaska. I realize we got a problem here, but they refuse to look realistic at what is going on.
Gibbertoni has a state-of-the-art boiler he estimates puts out around 3 grams of particulates per hour, half a gram higher than what the state is proposing for new units installed in the Fairbanks area. Gibbertoni is also suspect of the state's proposed burn ban authority and how it will be enforced.
It's not reasonable. Are they going to have smoke cops? I don't know if they're going to have smoke cops. I don't know where this is going to go.
The proposed regulations are in response to proven health impacts tied to breathing fine particulates, but some locals, like heart transplant survivor Ray Sobolski, aren't concerned.
You know, when people say, "Oh, it's heart," it's lung issues, it's this and that. I mean, I think I got just as much card on that as anybody else, in the simple fact that, you know, I had a heart transplant.
Cebulski says a virus damaged his original heart, but since the operation, he hasn't had any problems, despite working in town where smoke can be acute.
That's the honest truth. I mean, I work in an environment that is technically supposed to be really, really bad for you, and I've never had an issue.
Cebulski points out that smoky conditions are typically localized and often change quickly with the weather. The dismissive attitude frustrates people worried about air quality and its impacts on short and long-term health. Fairbanks resident Ron Yarnell says he's grown impatient with the drawn-out air quality debate.
We have a lot of people that aren't being responsible citizens. They just feel that their right to burn wood trumps other people's right to have good health.
Yarnell, who uses a wood stove, says he supports burn bans on bad days.
I'm tired of it. It's been so long. I think the state should just step in, or EPA, I don't care who does it, and just say this is the way it's going to be, and they can maybe make some exceptions for people that just don't have the money to be able to convert to other stuff.
Another local North Pole resident, Paul Finch, cites recent years spent living in a smoky city in Mongolia, an experience he says shows how bad air quality from wood burning can get.
I'm just glad to live in a country where we have a process that we can have air standards. That was the number one polluted city in the world. And so I know what it's like, and we don't want that. We can do better. It's America.
The state will hold a final public hearing on its proposed fine particulate pollution regulations January 21st in Fairbanks. The regulations are being developed for incorporation into a state implementation plan required by the Environmental Protection Agency. The state will also take public comment on that plan. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Supreme Court is now weighing whether to allow a voter referendum that would repeal Anchorage's controversial labor law. Attorneys on both sides of the issue made their cases before the justices yesterday. KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports.
About two dozen people sat in the audience while attorneys for the municipality of Anchorage and labor supporters argued before five Supreme Court justices. Anchorage attorney Michael Gaddy argued for the city that the referendum shouldn't go ahead. He said the labor law is inherently administrative in character, not legislative, something the municipality has argued from the beginning, and therefore shouldn't go before voters.
We believe this is a matter that is not subject to direct democracy and not subject to the referenda.
The referendum allows voters to decide whether the labor ordinance, also known as AO 37, should be reversed. The assembly passed the law last March despite protests. The ordinance takes away municipal workers' right to strike and restricts collective bargaining rights. It would affect more than 2,000 city employees. Attorney Susan Orlansky, who represented labor supporters, argued the referendum should proceed.
What's really going on here is this ordinance in its entirety makes new law that fundamentally shifts the balance of power between labor and management in the Anchorage area, in Anchorage. And that's what we're asking the public to vote on.
The overarching question, Orlansky says, is does Anchorage want management to have more power and labor less? Andy Holloman, who's president of the Anchorage Education Association and one of the people who brought the case to court, says it's a simple decision that voters are equipped to make.
What we're doing is reversing the assembly's action on a given night. This puts it back like it was, and the city can come forward again with different aspects that they think matter. And hopefully they do it in the right way with real input from everybody in advance this time.
Anchorage Municipal Attorney Dennis Wheeler disagrees and says if the Supreme Court allows the referendum to go ahead and it passes, it could undermine the power of the city's legislative body and spur more litigation and referenda around labor issues.
You know, we already have a lot of give and take in our labor negotiations. We have arbitrations over what the contracts mean. We have grievances over what do the contracts mean. We have 9 different unions to deal with. We have budgetary issues every year. So, yeah, I was always worried that this would open a floodgate.
A floodgate that would be hard to close, he says. The deputy clerk for the municipality requested the judges have a decision by early February so that she'd have time to prepare ballots for elections slated for April. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's educational professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
The Copper Basin 300 appears to have another loaded race field with big-name veterans and a lot of rookies starting on Saturday. This year, 45 mushers from Alaska and five different countries will compete in the qualifier for the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod. KCHU's Tony Gorman has this preview.
So far this season, training is going well for Alan Moore.
We haven't had to go anywhere. A lot of years we have to go different places because we don't have enough snow or it's too cold or this, that, and the other, but... This year, it's been great.
Last year, the Two Rivers musher made history by being the first four-time winner of the Copper Basin 300.
I've ran it quite a few years, so I just know the trail well. We've had good dogs, and we've been kind of lucky. I think you got to, like any football team or basketball team, you got to have everything gelling at the same time at the moment, and I've had that happen a few times. So hopefully we can do it again, but that's what we're striving for.
That momentum carried him to a victory in the Yukon Quest. Moore is hoping to become a five-time CB300 champion, a two-time Yukon Quest champion, and a first-time Iditarod champion this season. He is one of several veterans and a large number of rookies from Alaska and five countries in a 45-team field in this year's CB300. Moore says he loves competing in the CB300 because you see every condition you would see in a 1,000-mile race.
Really gets you in the... I don't know, the groove, so to speak, checkpoint routines, all these things that takes place in a 1,000-mile race. It really gets you in sync with the dogs and your checkpoint routines.
Weather has played a role in the outcome of each of the last two races. In 2012, the race was canceled due to extremely cold temperatures. Last year, the thermometer went the opposite direction and melted the snow on the last leg of the trail. That forced officials to move the finish line from Glen Allen to Tulsana for most of the mushers. Race manager Zach Steer is cautiously optimistic that the trail conditions are ideal.
As you know, in Glen Allen, they just got another 6 or 8 inches of snow just on Saturday alone, so... We got good snow. We got the trail base in. Got our fingers crossed for a mild event. You know, the mushers like it to be, you know, right in that 0 to 10 below range for running dogs. That's the ideal running temperature. When it gets to be 20, 30, 40 below, then you're kind of pushing the limits and things get a little uncomfortable. We don't like to see that. It doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Other notables in this year's race include last year's runner-up Jerry Willemitzer, John Schandelmeyer, Brent Sass, and Ali Zirkel. The 2014 Copper Basin 300 start time is 10 a.m. Saturday in front of the KCAM building in downtown Glen Allen. The finish is at Old Pass Church, which is also in Glen Allen. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
It's no secret that Alaskan winters are cold. This year, the polar vortex has brought frigid temperatures into the lower 48 as well. There's one group of people who can freely scoff at everyone who bundles up for a mere 30 below, however. One of them lives in Talkeetna and spoke with Philip Manning from member station KTNA.
Alaskans are no strangers to testing themselves against the cold. From frigid runs in bunny boots from a sauna to large events like the Polar Plunge, residents of the 49th state often test their bodies against major temperature swings. As it turns out, there's an elite group that takes the prize when it comes to enduring massive changes in temperature, however. Antarctica's 300 Club. Talkeetna resident Chris Perry explains how it works.
Basically, every time that it would get below minus 100, we'd fire up the sauna. So you had to get the sauna up to 200 degrees, then you had to sit in the sauna, get good and hot, which of course isn't very hard in a 200-degree sauna, and then you would go out and go to the geographic pole and come back.
There's one other catch, too.
Typically doing it naked, too. Shoes are okay, because you don't want to, frostbite your feet.
Chris Perry recently talked to the magazine The Atlantic about the 300 Club. Says that the tradition started as early as the 1950s when those staying in Antarctica were largely members of the military. They supposedly built a hot box in order to warm up as much as possible before making the trek to the ceremonial South Pole. As research stations with saunas were built, it allowed members of the unofficial club to reach higher and higher temperatures before trekking out into the 100 below chill. Chris Perry says that he first joined the 300 Club in the Antarctic winter of 2002. He says his motivation for wanting to subject his body to a 300-degree temperature difference was fairly simple.
There's the history. You hear about it, and when you're wintering, I mean, not every winter ever wants to do it, but there's definitely enough of us that are like, oh yeah, we got to do the 300 Club, because how many people on this planet can say they've ever done that?
That first night, Chris Perry was not content to make the trek just once, however. Since he worked in the weather station, he knew exactly what the outside temperature was, and it simply got too warm on his first two attempts. Finally, on the third attempt, Chris thinks the temperature took a dive all the way down to 101 below.
And so I went out, got back, and I ran in the office, and it was all good. But every time when I was coming in, I was looking. I mean, like, every body hair was just totally frosted over. Like, you know, think how the hoarfrost looks on the trees and all that. It's like every hair in my body was like that. And I'm like, oh, man, that is so cool. I got to get someone to take a picture of this.
So he rounded up someone from the bar and made the walk a fourth time, then posed next to a snowman. That was still not Chris Perry's last 300 Club walk of the night, however.
But then, you know, it got to be about 5 in the morning when the early risers were getting up, and some couple wanted to go out, and, it, you know, temperature was good again. And I'm just one of those crazy people. I'm like, oh, I'll go do it with you.
100 degrees below zero is seriously cold. It doesn't take exposed skin long to succumb to frostbite, and the cold can literally freeze your lungs after a while. The walk totals a few hundred yards, and it's done at 9,300 feet of elevation. The time it takes to make the frosty trek varies, but it's generally just a few minutes. Even so, Chris Perry says proper technique is important to avoid injury to sensitive areas.
Some people were always in a hurry. They were trying to run the thing, which was crazy, because you would start sucking in that air, and you'd hear them for the next day or two coughing, and they'd get over it. But I just always walked fast. I didn't run. I walked where I didn't have to breathe heavy, and I'd keep one hand over my mouth and one hand over the boys, and I'd be fine.
Chris Perry says that his spot in the 300 Club is special to him. Not everyone who stays the winter at the bottom of the world is willing to undertake the challenge, and some years it simply does not get cold enough for those who do want to make the attempt. While he freely admits that it's a little crazy, he also says it's an important rite of passage for the complete Antarctic experience. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Tony Gorman in Valdez, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Electronic health records give doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where it's needed most. If it's providing a new doctor access to your child's medical history or taking a loved one to the emergency room, electronic health records provide safe, secure, life-saving information on the spot. For more information, go to ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.